chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Charlotte, how are you up there? It's colder than what? You know what, right?
Yeah, we got some snow, but things are great. It's good to be here with you.
Okay, we've got one of the finest guests we've ever had, Paul Williams, Paul L. Williams, Dr. Williams out of Pennsylvania. And he's written a book, a fine book, on Operation Gladio. Welcome to our program, Paul Williams.
Well, thanks, George and Charlotte. It's good to be with you guys.
Well, I tell you what, you've got such insight to the big picture. But first, why don't you tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
I got kind of the Lord has blessed me with a very, very interesting background. First of all, I began by, I was a PhD student studying under Will Herberg, and Catholic monks in Latin and medieval theology at Drew University. After graduating, I taught for a while at the University of Scranton and Wilkes University, and then I became a journalist. And I had my own newspaper here in Pennsylvania. I was the editor and publisher, and that newspaper won a lot of awards and covered a lot of bad stuff. Exposed the Pizza Triangle, for instance, in New Jersey. And then I went on from there to write, I guess, about 15 books. And I've been blessed with wonderful publishers. Doubleday, Penguin, Macmillan, Prometheus. They've all been, especially this latest publisher, is very, very brave to take this book on. The latest book is called Operation Gladio, The Unholy Alliance Between the Vatican, the CIA, and the Mafia. And nobody would touch it because it's such a controversial subject. But I came upon the subject, to directly answer your question, by after 9/11, doing a lot of research on radical Islam. I read a lot of books on that. And then I discovered, as you guys might know, that the CIA brought many of the world's most radical imams into the country, like Blind Sheikh Rahman, who was responsible for the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. And I really like Sheikh Jilani, the leader of Jamaat al-Fukra, was brought here with CIA passports. That's the first thing I learned. And I figured, man, this, you know, the radical Islam, and we're bringing these radical mosques in, or the radical imams in. And then I realized that the most radical mosque in the country, like the Al-Fukr Mosque, which I visited several times in Brooklyn, New York, is probably the most radical mosque maybe in the world. There's a cell of Al-Qaeda there, for instance. The planners of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing met there. The assassination of Meir Kahane was planned there. They raised more than $24 million for Al-Qaeda. I could go on about the Farouk Mosque. But then I realized, and I get this, George and Charlotte, that the Farouk Mosque was receiving, this is throughout this time, millions of dollars a year from the federal government. And I think, man, I was believing the Republican Party. I was, believing that the radical Islam, these people were madmen who were intent upon destroying this country. But then I realized that, man, the CIA is sponsoring them. And then I started to look, and this is most importantly, at a guy by the name of Fethullah Gulen. He's been called the most dangerous Muslim in the world. He's the driving force behind something called the New Islamic World Order. he's uniting all of Central Asia in an effort to reconstruct the Ottoman Empire. And then I realized that Gulen has received tens of millions of dollars. As a matter of fact, he has over between 30 to 50 billion with a B in assets, most of it from the CIA. And at that point, I realized that everything I had formerly been led to believe was a lie. And I came to believe that behind the semblance of everything, what you see on the news every night and what you see reading the newspaper, is a reality. And that reality is that there's a group who are engineering our government, who are planning almost everything that's being done by the USA. And it's a nefarious group. I think it's basically demonic, and that it really has to be exposed. So when I talk to people, when I even said, started to talk to people about this book, including many of my old publishers, and I write for a living. I'm not a self-published writer. I mean, I have to get a contract to write a book, because for me, it's very expensive, because I go out and do my homework. I get on planes, I travel to the mosque. For instance, for my last book, Crescent Moon Rising, about radical Islam, I traveled probably everywhere in the country, including Texas. I was in Texas, I was in Oklahoma, I was in California, I was everywhere, and I live in Pennsylvania. But in any case, to write this book, I realized it would require an awful lot of work, going down to Washington, trying to get information from the Freedom of Information Act, getting access to documents, which is, you know, people listening to this program will think, oh, under the Freedom of Information Act, all you need to do is say what documents you want and you get them. That's not the case. You really have to go down there and you have to get support from your legislators, and you have to really start screaming that they demand these documents. And once again, that requires travel, especially for me. And right now, the book was published in several days ago, and I am determined to do everything in my power to make that book a success. Not for me, because I'll never recuperate the money I have into it. Never, never, never. I won't even make, out of the whole effort, $10,000, and I put much more than that into it. But what I think is most important about the book, and even appearing on a show like this, is to inform the American people of what they're doing. What they're doing by supporting the government. What they're doing by supporting Obama and Bush and the Clintons and even Reagan. I mean, they were all part of this. And I'd like to say that some of them were better than others, but they were all tied in, even Reagan, to the Council on Foreign Relations. Every Secretary of State that we've had, and George, you're my age, and every Secretary of State that we've had in our lifetime was tied into the CFR. Everyone. And they control the State Department. They control our policy. That's why there's never a change in policy. That's why you say, oh, Hillary's running against Jeb Bush, and we have to support Jeb Bush. Well, no matter who wins, the CFR will still be in control of the State Department, and the situation will go on. And America, right, and the beliefs of the American people, this is, I'm running on at the mouth. And I should
no, go ahead, office. Continue. You have plenty of time.
But what I see is, you know, there's this drive to create a new world order, a uniformity of belief, a belief that America is not a place defined by borders. It's not a place united by a common creed, common race, common heritage. That America is a country united by an idea, a constitution, a concept of democracy. That's baloney. Americans are united by blood. But it goes beyond that. And people are starting to believe that we can plant democracies anywhere, in Iraq, anywhere else, and they'll thrive because America is an idea. But that's, once again, that's the first thing that we were led to believe. Secondly, Americans are now led to believe that multiculturalism is a wonderful thing. We should embrace all cultures. It's all good to be open and affirming. Well, every culture, if you look through history, every culture that embraced another culture, that became multicultural, even going back to Greek, the Greco-Roman times, was, as soon as that happened, they were destroyed. Now we're led to believe that diversity is just wonderful virtue. And look, there's only one source of the truth. When you believe that truth is multifaceted, you're in a lot of trouble.
Right. You know, your interview, I listened to your interview on Coast to Coast the other night, and George Norrie was saying, now what was that and what was that? And you were coming out with one expose after another, and you basically studied, I think, everything that Charlotte and I together have studied over the last 25 or 35 years, you know? Your idea,
yeah,
the big picture, he has the big picture, doesn't he, Charlotte?
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to hear you speak, and all the literature that you've written and all the information you've gathered. I mean, a lot of us, for me, sorry to turn it on me, George, but for me, there's a lot of people right now, we really don't understand our heritages, our ethnicities, our language arts, the way language has changed. And one of the things that concerns me is, like, when we say democracy, like, I'm sitting in the United States, and when I say the word democracy, a certain definition pops to my mind. But I was raised in Northern California Public School District. When a person in South America hears the word democracy, what comes to their mind? You know, and when you look at our books, the Oxford dictionaries and these kind of academic tracers of the English language, you know, they'll have four definitions for a single word. And I feel like we're all having a conversation. We're all pointing at the same thing, and we're all having a conversation, but there seems to be a tangling of the tongues. That makes sense?
What do you think, Paul?
Yep. I think that once you start astray, the thing that was unique about our country is the Bill of Rights. And once you start to strip away our rights, and I've experienced that firsthand, then you're no better off than a Guatemalan or a Honduran or somebody living in the Congo. For instance, I was tried in Canada under Canadian law for something I said on Coast to Coast. George Norrie, by the way, was very brave to have me on that show.
Yes, he has guts, doesn't he? He's brave about that.
And he had me on for 3 hours. And, you know, he knew what... The last time I was on George Norrie's show, I mean, I got sued. I mean, problems arose. But I was tried, as a matter of fact, for my appearance I had on there about 4 or 5 years ago. I was being sued in Canada under Canadian law for something I said in the United States on the George Norrie show. I believe that. It was carried on airways. And George and Charlotte, let me tell you, I was sued there. My lawyers told me the trial was going to go to The Hague. So once your rights are taken away as American, and I was right, our truth is not an ultimate defense in Canada.
The truth has no politics, you know?
Yeah.
Truth has no politics. The truth is what it is. Go ahead, continue. I'm sorry.
But George, what happened there is, you know, what I said was perfectly right under you know, as a journalist, under the guidelines of American journalism, and my rights as a journalist under freedom of speech and freedom of the press. But in Canada, doesn't have the Bill of Rights, and therefore I was tried, and I resented this as an American. In a Canadian court of law, and the trial, I was told, was going to take place in The Hague. Now think about this. So as a writer, once again, I'm not self-published. I was always supported by publishing companies.
Right.
Once you're sued, and if you don't fight it, if you don't fight it and win and prove your case, you're done. You're dust because nobody will touch you.
Yeah,
try to fight the darn thing. And I have a wonderful wife, same wife of 44 years, and she stood by me. But at the end of the day, I mean, I prevailed, but I was financially devastated. So, this could happen. We are losing our rights as Americans, and it's all taking place because of this effort to create a new world order. And anyone who doesn't believe that, and that new world order requires a surrender of your long-cherished beliefs, especially if you're Christians. For instance, you can see that. In 2008, during the presidential process of getting candidates, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and John McCain and Mitt Romney all were opposed to same-sex marriage. You guys remember that. all of this. They're talking about the most basic unit of society, the family. If you can't define that or know what that is, you're in trouble. And in 2008,
excuse me for interrupting. You know, I've been contemplating the whole origin of the family thing for practically my whole adult life. It was one of those scenes that came on the American culture back in the 80s when the sort of Christian coalition, you know, hell, Israel during the 80s in Northern California was advertising to the population saying, are you a Jew that misses your homeland? Here, you may qualify for some money to move to Israel. And they painted it to look like Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, it's what I'm getting at is that you know, we're trying to take a picture of a moving thing, and but where did the family come from? My personal experience. I don't have beliefs. I don't have beliefs. All I have are experiences.
Yeah.
And from the life that I've lived up to nearly 50 years old today, I've been on the hunt for that elusive thing, the contract between a man and a woman, the covenant.
Art
of the covenant.
Yeah.
The contract between the man and the woman. I traced it to Finland.
Yeah.
And there was some heathen culture that was well preserved in oral tradition that tells the story of when Christendom, call it Catholic, whatever, call it Protestant, call it Christian, but when Christendom arrived in Northern Europe, in that part of Finland, okay, it was 1050 BC, and they said that prior to 1050 BC, or excuse me, not BC, after Christ. Forgive me. I mean it's 1050
after Christ. You guys have got to be way off there.
Right.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm Latin. I come from the Latin school. I come from the Latin school of education. I was educated by Catholics that were highly educated people.
Yeah.
But then I was sent off of like an orphan in a basket down the waterway in the world, you know, I had to make my way with some very conflicting information and emotions. And what I'm getting at, though, is that so they said that there was a breeding program that came that they said that humanity had suffered some sort of catastrophic catastrophe, potentially an asteroid or something that challenged the actual survival of the human race. And the myth went that it's called the Bach Saga. Anyways, they practiced a breeding program. There was a reason why people, they would, the maypole, okay, the theology or the ideas or the sacred geometry behind the cultural phenomena that is.
What's the point, Charlotte? Yeah.
Well, I think there's substantial evidence in the archaeological record that marriage is a construct of the thought construct that brought us Christianity, dating back.
You look at the ancient Egyptian civilization, which you're going back 20 BC or 2000 BC, and I mean you have marriage there. You have marriage in the ancient Phoenician culture. You certainly have marriage in the ancient Jewish culture, which goes back about the same amount of time. All of our written records point to marriage, to the concept of marriage.
Right.
It's saying it comes from a meteor. I don't know where in the world that is. And Christianity, by the way, Christianity, first of all, Christ, by all accounts, at the latest or the earliest was crucified in 33 A.D. And by the time Christianity came to Finland, I mean, you're talking the 9th century.
Yeah.
I know. 1050 after Christ is what I meant to say. I meant after Christ. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Right.
Well, I think my.
So I'm telling you that I found this saga, gentlemen. It's called the Bach Saga. And it's an oral tradition, and I think the most connected language to it is Swedish.
Okay.
And the root language is the closest to it, because it was an oral tradition that came to modernity through antiquity, through time, and through epistemology, you know, just came to us over time. And
hold on.
Okay.
This is going nowhere. Epistemology is a study of knowledge, and I mean that's what epistemology means.
Sorry, gentlemen.
Yeah. We went way off topic there on that, but let's get back to Gladio. In addition to Gladio, there was another, a Condor, operation down in the South American area. Is that right?
Operation Condor was the Latin American version of Gladio.
Right.
It was an attempt to undermine all the left wing regimes throughout the area, even throughout Central America. And it was initiated in the 1970s. It brought about the revolutions in Brazil and in Chile, and in Bolivia and in Argentina.
Yeah.
And almost throughout the entire area, Honduras. That was Gladio. But what they did was the CIA would launch a terrible attack, and it would be blamed on the leftist. And because of that, people would support military juntas and right wing regimes, and that was all to gain control for our State Department of much of South America.
Right. The Gladio, it began though back in Europe, I think, after World War II? And, Dr. Ganser out of the Switzerland, him, and he's written a book on this, and we've looked at this, Charlotte and I have looked at this over the years. I guess we've looked at it, 4 or 5 years, Charlotte, or longer? Something like that? And, at least that long. And we've had several people, Todd Fletcher out of the West Coast out there, spoke, quite eloquently about it also. You seem to say, in a previous, interviews that the Condor program, our Pope Francis was, involved in the Argentine, situation and history of that Condor program. What would you say about that?
George, first of all, I would say, what I say about it doesn't amount to a hill of beans.
Right.
What actually happened does matter, and this is all documented.
Sure,
it's not for me.
Okay,
and anybody that picks up anything I write would, especially this book, will find a footnote at the end of every sentence,
sure,
and to find a reference to documents that they can even look up on the internet. I mean, declassified documents. So. But Francis, when he at that time was known as Jorge Maria Bergoglio, he was the Secretary General of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, in Buenos Aires. And he was close friends with General Videla, who was the head of the military junta who took over Argentina at that time. And they instituted what was called a dirty war. And that took place between 1976 to 1982. And during that course of time, at a bare minimum, 30,000 people were rounded up. They were taken, like people like you, if they didn't hear Charlotte, the junta didn't like you or they thought you were thinking the wrong way. You'd be loaded onto a cargo plane. You'd be transported over the ocean and dumped off. And at least 30,000 disappeared. Torture chambers were set up throughout Buenos Aires. Most of this was to defeat liberal liberation theology and, once again, to oppose any left-wing political party. Well, Bergoglio, who was head of the Society of Jesus at that time, turned over several of his priests to the junta and members of their congregation for supporting liberation theology. They were taken to a torture chamber. Many of them never returned. And he took an active part in Condor, as did the Catholic Church. And in 2008, the participants in the Dirty War were taken to court, and they were charged with criminal offenses. And this is what most people in America right now don't know, or one of the things they don't know, is that Bergoglio, Pope Francis, at that time, was charged in a criminal court in Argentina with crimes against humanity. Now he's presented as this great humanitarian, as this guy who wouldn't hurt a fly, as this person who doesn't want to judge anything. He did judge quite a bit in the 1970s when he was very active there, and he is the only pope in history to be charged with crimes against humanity.
Right. Is he the only Jesuit pope, too, that we've had in Rome? Is that correct?
Yep. But,
and so that's doubly troubling, isn't it?
Well, I think if a pope came from the Dominican order or the Augustinian order, it wouldn't matter to me, or even the Jesuit order. The Jesuit order traditionally was never under the control of any diocese, under the control of any bishop. The Jesuits are only answerable to the pope, and a lot of people have problems with the Jesuits. I taught with the Jesuits. I have problems with them too. But I do not think that it matters. I think the thing that does matter is that Bergoglio was part of this operation, and that Bergoglio, throughout his career, was joined at the hip with the CIA, as were many of the other popes. And according to all documents, the CIA used the Vatican Bank as a laundry. When a pope who was considered a simpleton was elected due to the CIA, who controlled, according to documents, duly declassified documents, controlled much of the conclave. When John Paul I was elected pope in 1978, and he decided to look into what was going on at the Vatican Bank, he died under very mysterious circumstances.
Right. Calvi, and another name that crops up, too, is Lucio Gelli.
Oh, Lucio Gelli, yeah.
Yeah, Gelli. Now, he's still alive, isn't he?
He's still alive. He's about 97 years old. He was in charge of propaganda, too, a Masonic lodge. It was tied in with the Vatican. Another guy who was very much involved in that was the Vatican banker, Michele Sandana, these guys set up shell companies off the coast of Panama. And the purpose of these shell companies, that they became places where people from the Colombian cartels were making deposits. And the shell companies also began to borrow vast sums of money from a bank in Milan called Banco Ambrosiano. And the directors of Banco Ambrosiano were told that these companies that were set up in off the coast of Panama were Catholic concerns. The Vatican told them this, that they in writing, that these companies were concerns of the Vatican. They were involved in the sale of parochial goods, including statues of Mary to Latin American peoples and rosaries and things like that, prayer missiles, and so the people who controlled Banco Ambrosiano started loaning millions and millions and millions of dollars to these shell companies. Eventually, they provided over $1.5 billion to these companies, and the companies were all bogus, and the money just disappeared, and it created a huge financial collapse in Italy, devastated hundreds of thousands of Italian families, and once again, that was all part of Gladio, the way that the operation was funded.
Right. Calvi winds up, being hung under Blackfriars Bridge in London, I believe.
That's interesting because the members of P2, Jelly's group, call themselves Blackfriars.
Yes.
And it was a Masonic order. And the way he died, the way Calvi was killed, he was hanged, as you said, from Blackfriars Bridge with his feet dangling in the water.
Yes.
Which for at P2 was part of the, when you took the oath of secrecy, that you would never divulge any secrets, you would say, if I fail to keep my pledge, may my feet be dangling in the water and may I be hanged by the neck.
Right, right. It's a big money power operation, it seems like. All these, did you ever do any research on Le Cercle by any chance?
No.
Okay. And that's just another one. And how about the...
I know about it. George. I know about it, but I've never really probed into it.
How about the Malta? You know, the Knights of Malta, almost every CIA.
Yeah, a lot of the people in,
yeah, go
a
ahead.
Lot of the people involved in the CIA were very prominent members of the Knights of Malta. That's for sure. Including, I used to write for William F. Buckley. I worked at National Review. So, yeah, I'm very familiar with that. James Jesus Angleton was a very prominent member of the Knight of Malta. Jelly, like you said, was a Knight of Malta. Many of the CIA directors were Knights of Malta, including Casey and including, going back to the OSS, to William Wild Bill Donovan. So they were certainly instrumental in, as a matter of fact, Cardinal Spellman used to conduct gladio meetings at when the Knights of Malta held conferences.
My gosh.
At their conferences, yeah.
I know that you probably tracked all of this Nazis that were smuggled out of post-Nazi Germany.
Sure.
Over what? And then they got them down. Now, Martin Bormann wound up, they say, in Buenos Aires and administrating billions of dollars. Is that what you've come up with yourself for your studies?
Well, I think the one that's more interesting, Bormann, would be Klaus Barbie, who ended up helping the CIA in establishing the cocaine trade and became a right-hand man under Hugo Banzer Suarez under his regime. But Barbie, who was called one of the main butchers of the Third Reich, was a highly elevated CIA operative, and he remained in Bolivia until the time of his death, made billions and billions of dollars.
And how about Heinrich Mueller, chief of the Gestapo? He figures.
Well, I didn't get it. Yeah,
yeah.
I know that all these people were part of Operation Paperclip, and they were part of the rat lines that were set up by the Vatican, and most of them flowed. A lot of them ended up in the United States, by the way, George.
Now let me ask you this. It seems like to me that it's a mentality when we can get compartmentalized too much using the word Nazi or fascism or whatever. But it looks like there's a certain mentality here of dictators and tyrants that have come together to run this new world order. What do you think?
I don't think that's the case. I don't think I think they're all puppets. I think that the people like you and I and Charlotte are ants. I think that the people within the CFR right now are not just individuals. Primarily, they're corporations.
Okay.
Every leading bank is tied in with the CFR. Every leading industrial complex is tied in there. Every major American company, including Coke and Pepsi, are tied in there. The major producers of our entertainment, the major media moguls, companies, including News Corp, which controls Fox News, are all part of the CFR. And I think this industrial complex, military-industrial complex, if you will, I think they control it. And I think that the money that they have control it. I think they're more interested in. They're interested in creating a global economy where they can produce the cheapest goods and amass the greatest profits, whether that disseminates the middle class or not. And it requires a strategy of tension, so that you always have upheavals in country after country after country that results in. A government or a form of economy that's suitable to their needs.
Right. What'd you say, Charlotte? What was your?
Oh, I just wanted to apologize for getting a little carried away, Delman.
That's okay. Yeah, go ahead, Charlotte.
Yeah, when I sit and listen to you guys talk, I am learning my own cultural history, and it just blows me away. I want to go down on the record that I think that the Fabian Society, okay, that came to the United States with Charlotte Iserby and her books and stuff like that, George, I think it's tied to a what did you call it? When I think of a Catholic, I don't think of, oh, you called it an order. An order of Catholics called the Franciscans. That they collaborated with the Tavistock Institute, with Berkeley. I mean, it wasn't our cultural imagination.
No, we studied, Paul, just to give you some background, you know, like the Aspen Institute, the Trilateral Commission, you've studied CFR, you've got to look at.
What about Rome?
Yeah, the Fabian Society goes back to the 1880s.
I know everything. I mean, I know. I know all about the Fabian Society. I know when it was created in the 19th century. H.G. Wells, I know the whole thing. I know going through Cecil Rhodes and,
I see a connection to an order of thought of Catholic persuasion, a sect of Catholicism that adheres to the Franciscan line or whatever, however you want to put it. I'm not, I was born, I think, into an ultra-Orthodox. My father, it was in my lifetime when they stopped speaking Latin to my immediate family at the Mass.
Okay.
My father had this dualistic thinking, that he does to this day as he watches history unfold. It's crazy. And then to have, I just think there's a connection there. Okay, I just want to put that out there and make food for thought, whatever. I'd love to discuss it with anybody.
Yeah, there's a lot of different groups that are confluencing there. Now, we just covered the Davos meeting over there at World Economic Forum, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk, when you brought up the corporate connection, they're all there every year, over 2,500 corporations. And it is a nexus for meeting together. And actually, it seems like to me that those Tavistock ideas coming out of Kurt Lewin's research, Germany by way of Tavistock over to America, is that group hive thinking that they actually are conditioning those people at the World Economic Forum into a way of thinking and being for the future New World Order, see?
George, unless you look at what the bottom line is, I think that you lose it when you start thinking it's about ideas or like when people say it's a new world order that it's a political concept. It comes from political theorists or the Fabian Society. It doesn't. It comes from economics. It's geo-economics. The bottom line here is to create a world in which the flow of goods is unhampered, and the flow of profits is unhampered by any tariffs or any breakdowns like that. The flow of capital is unhampered by anything, and that's the idea there. The means of production are under one control. That's the concept. Marx was right there. It all comes down to economics. And it doesn't come down to like any concept that any thinker ever thought, but it comes down to that. And they realize, the people, I believe, in the Trilateral Commission who can largely control CFR, that's why so many corporations are involved there. It's to do away with the sovereignty of America. It's to do away with things that make America distinct, because all of that is in the way.
Right. Well, the reason why I brought up the World Economic Forum, because it is about economics there, see?
They
do a lot of hive thinking, see, to get everybody in line on the same page, see? You know what I mean?
Well, I think it all emanates from that one group that works very closely with the CIA. I think that's where the problem is, at least from my perspective.
I can understand that. That's for sure. And
these other agencies, you got to realize that in 1947, when the CIA was formed, you got to realize that they began their involvement in covert operations. They said the first thing was the establishment of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stay-behind units throughout Germany, throughout Italy, throughout Western Europe, even in Turkey, to ward off a Soviet invasion. That was the purpose of Gladio. You had, in 1947, you had under the newly created CIA, hundreds and hundreds of military units throughout Europe that you had to provide munitions for, training for, provisions for. It was an enormous expense. And there were other covert operations the CIA wanted to become involved in. So let me ask you and Charlotte a question. Okay, the United States, the American people at that time, didn't want to fork a bill for, you know, billions and billions of dollars to keep foreign soldiers, or foreign soldiers on foreign soil, these Gladio units in Europe. They didn't want to pay, fork out billions and billions of dollars to overthrow the president of Iran. They didn't want to fork out thousands, billions of dollars to establish a new government in Greece, or let alone Operation Condor. So where does the money come from? It can't come from line item budget, because then you would expose what you're doing. And now we know all these covert operations took place and continue to take place, and they're very, very expensive. I mean, you're talking billions and billions and billions of dollars a year. Well, where does the money come from? You're not going to find it in any federal budget.
Drug operations, for one thing.
Weapon sales.
Yeah.
We never talked about it, but
Charlotte, you
have a history of weapons manufacturing. I have a background in Army ordnance, and there is a lot of armament, a lot of weapons, a lot of war.
You have to buy the weapons.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you manufacture them, you need the money to manufacture them. Where does that money come from?
Well, you got the Federal Reserve there.
The chicken or the egg?
You got the Federal Reserve
it's not the chicken or the egg. The answer is Alfred McCoy, who's one of the leading researchers probably in the world, Peter Dale Scott. And if you look at any declassified document, you'll get the answer to that. The answer came in going all the way back to 1947 to heroin.
Yeah.
We brought heroin in with the mafia. That's how the tie-in was that. And it was sold to the black communities. They believed that the blacks were just perfect people to sell drugs to, because they established these jazz clubs. They were using reefers, and that at that time was unheard of, marijuana. So people like Paul E. Helliwell and Alan Dulles and Donovan, William Wild Bill Donovan, sanctioned the and this is all verified. The sale of heroin into the black communities began in 1947. It was very successful. We started producing more and more heroin, especially from the Golden Triangle, and that brought us into the poppy fields of Burma and Thailand and Laos, and that brought us into Vietnam. And after the Vietnam conflict, where do we go? To the Golden Crescent of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. But it's all been heroin. Heroin's plugged into the Andrews Air Force Base.
Well, you make an interesting point there, too, about the Dulles brothers, see? They had to create an idea that this communist thing was a big enemy, and they had to mobilize the military-industrial complex to fight this new enemy called the Soviet Union. So
The enemy might have been real, George. At that time, I think it was.
Well, but to a degree, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, but in time, and then everybody started to support this, I think with good intentions, believing they were making the world safe for democracy. But then, later, when after the fall of the Soviet Union, you still have this same enterprise.
The Vietnam thing is the key, because the Golden Triangle was right in the 60s, see? So you're right about the drugs, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. And about the concept of, I think this was enacted because of the rise of the national security state in America in that time frame that you're speaking of.
That's what Peter Dale Scott talked about, too, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the time frame that you're talking about, I have a lot of different things that come to my mind, but so we're talking about Israel was happening also, and the creation of the national security agencies and all this.
Well, that's what Paul was saying in 47, seeing later on, you had the NSA created. So, but here's a point that a friend of mine makes, Paul.
What about Posse Comitatus?
Yeah. Okay, wait just one second, Charlotte. What they've been able to do is hide behind national security secrecy. That's what they've been doing. That way they could carry out the drug operations and the manufacturing and the supplying and the Condor operation, Gladio, in secrecy. So the national...
George, let me tell you something that, that you and Charlotte, that in the 1970s, there was a church committee that looked into the CIA and drugs.
Yeah.
And it was all brought before them. In 1989... John Kerry, who I'm certainly not a Kerry fan, he set up a commission, and it came out that the CIA was involved in a major player in the heroin industry and laundering money through all these banks that were bogus.
Right.
Now this was exposed. This wasn't a...
Yeah.
Pretty, and I can too, that it was kept in the American people. But the American...
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, we're losing you a little bit.
That.
Yeah. And nothing happened.
You have to realize.
Now, nothing happened.
The only thing that happened is, and I see it every day, instead of people really becoming informed about issues, they're tied into The View, these other dumber than dumb programs that they watch hour after hour after hour that destroy their brain cells. And they could care less.
They've been dumbed down, Paul. The Americans have been dumbed down into a lot of entertainment and Hollywood and everything else. And the wrong thinking about the wrong thing.
Maybe they're always dumb, George. I don't know. Maybe they're dumb when we were kids.
Well, now here's... Okay, the delusion is real because they've been deluded with wrong ideas. See, that's the problem. See? They've been taught... Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Paul.
Going back to something that Charlotte said.
Yeah.
He's talking about the Franciscans, and I know the Franciscans were instrumental in the creation of Catholic Croatia and set up death camps under the Third Reich. I understand all that, but you got to realize that in the 1940s and 50s, we had the creation of the United Council of Churches. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And then the World Council of Churches?
Yeah.
Do you know who created
that? No, I don't remember that. I don't know.
Well, it was a great influential movement, and the creator of that it was John Foster Dulles.
Yes.
Had nothing to do with religion.
Yeah. Well,
so it's not just the Catholic Church. It's not just the Catholic Church pressing for the New World Order. And
it's everybody. It's all the top dogs. The Dulles brothers. John Foster. And Alan Dulles together, though, were daily talking to one another, according to Stephen Kinzer, who I interviewed last fall.
Sure.
So they helped fuel this whole thing about the Cold War, you know, that could mobilize the minds of America to support all of this armament and stuff, see?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a pretty important dynamic. And now we've got a new enemy called the Muslim enemy, do we not?
Yeah, but it wasn't just, once you started to confine it to, they were working in tandem with a wide variety of people. You got to realize that.
Yeah, that's true.
When Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles were in power, they created something called Operation Nightingale that involved, for instance, every member of the press, William Paley from CBS, Catherine Graham, the head of the publisher and owner of the Washington Post. They controlled everything.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just John Foster Dulles and Allen. It was
right.
A group that was really
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah. But that group put out propaganda, and those are ideas that could mobilize people and to dilute people. The delusion is real of the public at large in America. They're in a deluded state, see? That's the problem where you can't reach them.
Hey, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Forgive me for interrupting. I just have to put this out here. One of the pressures that bothers me when I think about the things that we're discussing is that, in 1990, I suffered through a population bottleneck in California. Too many people were in California. And I was one of the kids that got on a bus I was put on a plane and I went to Texas with the military industrial complex. My mother, worked with Lockheed. And the problem here is there's been a population growth. In 1990, it was 3.5 billion people worldwide. And if I'm to understand what I, the information I get today, the population is over 7 billion. That's double. That's, we're entering exponential human growth.
What do you think, Paul, about the population thing?
How does that relate to, I don't get it. I'm going off subject again. But
yeah.
How is that related? I don't know. I don't understand.
Okay. So, these are major, mechanisms to manipulate people, are they not?
Well, yeah, but I mean, once again, you know, I mean, the world economy, the more people, of course, the greater the economy. So I think that I don't think that these people are very very much concerned with population growth as they are with certainly if they're a billion-dollar people more born in the next few years in Africa and in India and China, I don't think they care.
Right. What kind of modern more current Gladio type of operations have you witnessed, or you think that might have been special operations carried out in the last few years that would come to your mind?
Well, what I think, once again, George, doesn't matter. And what Charlotte thinks, I hate to say it, and what you think, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What matters is what actually happened.
Okay.
For instance, we know from going back to 1964.
Okay.
Lyndon Johnson was on national TV, and you remember this, George, and I do because we lived through it.
Sure.
And he said the North Vietnamese fired upon our fleet in the Gulf of Tonkin, that there are hundreds of American soldiers dead and floating on top of the water, and we have to do something. So we got the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and that brought us into Vietnam. Well, what happened was, you know, nobody fired up upon our fleet in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Right.
No sailors were killed. It was all a lie. But it brought us into a war. And, I mean, all that is very well established. Anybody can look that up right now. I mean, that's an established lie. In 1991, George H.W. Bush was on television saying that Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. His troops have gone into the Kuwaiti hospitals. They've removed babies from incubators, and they have thrown them on the floor to die. And George H.W. Bush said that Saddam Hussein was worse than Adolf Hitler, and we have to get a resolution, and we have to go in there and stop him and drive him out of Kuwait. The Persian Gulf War started. None of that happened. The French, the international press descended on the Kuwaiti hospitals. None of that happened. It was all bogus. In 1997, 1998, Bill Clinton said that in Kosovo right now, we've got a guy by the name of Slobodan Milosevic, who is taking ethnic Albanians, and he's massacring them wholesale. There's genocide there. In a town called Rasak, there are hundreds of ethnic Albanians who have been slaughtered, who have been decapitated, and their bodies are just rotting in the gutters. And so guess what? We bombed the living daylights out of Kosovo. None of that ever happened. It was just absolutely fabrication. Then you have in 2001, after the Taliban announces the eradication of the poppy crop, you have the fact that we're going to war against the Taliban. Well, what has the Taliban ever done to us?
Right. You know, well, they
were.
I know.
Go ahead. They're doing Al-Qaeda.
There's heroin up there in the northern part. Why, again, we get back to drugs, don't we?
In the southern part.
Is the southern part?
Yeah.
I thought it was all over. Different place up in the mountains.
Basically through the Helmand Valley. That's
okay.
That's the heartland of it.
Okay.
Well,
but,
gentlemen,
once again, and if you want to go on, you said more recently, you could go to even with Saddam Hussein in 2003. that he's using chemical weapons and has weapons of mass destruction. None of that ever happened. Now you have in Ukraine, you have reports that these Russian nationals are in Ukraine killing the Ukrainians, trying to make the Ukraine part of Russia. And then we've discovered that, guess what? These people who are supposed to be Russian nationalists who are killing the Ukrainian people, you know, all that is even that Malaysian plane that was shot down. It's all been false flag reports.
Right.
Gentlemen, the Gulf of Tonkin, I mean, we've covered a lot of ground here, but the Gulf of Tonkin incident event, the false flag, you know, what was happening also at that time was Zionism that had come through history from, you know, prior, you know, the revolution, the October Revolution of Russia or whatever. You know, I'm not trying to blame specific people, but at that time going on there, there's a book in circulation that was also that speaks to this. It was written by a Zionist Mossad agent who claimed that during that time period, Mossad, the Zionist battle cry for war was, by deception, we shall do war.
Yeah.
And that should not be overlooked. There's a lot of power there in the Zionist movement that's interacting with our history.
What do you think, Paul?
Just to be on topic, you know, not, I didn't want
yeah.
to... We weren't talking about Zionism, which, by the way, comes from a guy by the name of Herzl, who was the founder of Zionist.
Okay.
And that dates back to 1896.
Okay,
and
good.
I'm
yeah.
very familiar with the, Zion,
okay.
with the Zionist movement. I mean,
sure.
That precedes all of this.
But getting back to these false flags are real, and they can be documented, is what you're basically saying here, isn't it?
I'm saying they're going on right now.
Right.
And it's all,
yeah.
it's going on in Syria right now.
Okay.
All that is part of Gladio.
Right. Now, how about we've spotted some of these gun shootings in the United States, some of these gun affairs, you know. We seem to think that maybe we've got an American Gladio going on within this country to a certain degree, but I mean it's hard to prove some of this. What do you think?
No, I think that's definitely it. Gladio has always operated. And once again, it was a CIA undertaking, I was a consultant for the FBI, but this was a CIA undertaking, and the strategy of tension, of course, was also used in the United States. There's no doubt about it.
Right. We've got about 3 to 4 minutes left. Would you like to make some concluding remarks, Paul?
The only thing I want, from our conversation, if anybody, I think that people, if they are interested, if there are good Americans, and if they want to know the truth, pick up a copy of Operation Gladio. I don't mean to bang my own horn, but if people don't support books like this, then the situation is going to persist.
Yeah, we have click-offs on our site right this evening that our listening audience can come into and buy that book directly. And if there's any additional material that you'd like to email me, I'll also put that up, and I'll put up a full explanation of the book, a description of it, and where they can get it. It's already up there right now. And we'll certainly recommend the book. It's a fine book. It's quite a few pages long, isn't it? And the research was really good.
There are over 2,000 footnotes in it. So,
right.
The footnotes will illuminate a lot of people. They can go there, and they're going to find that they're no bogus, just from an Internet site or somebody's own opinion. I mean, they're all from bona fide sources.
What I found is sometimes the footnotes or endnotes and sometimes the index are very important to read by themselves and then go back and forth into the book. See what I mean?
A writer is only as good as his sources. That's why I've never been too successfully. If you're relying on that, if your house is on sand, you're in trouble.
Right. But I want to thank you for being with us this evening. I know we got off point there for a little while, but we got back on pretty quickly. And Charlotte's got some very wide views. Thank you for your input, Charlotte, on some of those things. But I want to thank you again for being with us, Dr. Paul Williams, and we'll certainly like to have you back another time. Okay?
My pleasure. Take care, guys.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Right. Good night.
Thank you. Bye.